Chapter. Beyond the road where the snakes sunned themselves was a dense young thicket, and through it a dim-lighted path led a quarter of a mile. Then out of the dimness one emerged abruptly upon a level great prairie, which was covered with wild strawberry plants, vividly starred with prairie pinks and walled in on all sides by forests. The strawberries were fragrant and fine, and in the season we were generally there in the crisp freshness of the early morning, while the dew beads still sparkled upon the grass, and the woods were ringing with the first songs of the birds. Down the forest slopes to the left were the swings. They were made of bark stripped from hickory saplings. When they became dry, they were dangerous. They usually broke when a child was 40 feet in the air, and this was why so many bones had to be mended every year. I had no ill luck myself, but none of my cousins escaped. There were 8 of them, and at one time and another they broke 14 arms among them. But it cost next to nothing, for the doctor worked by the year, $25 for the whole family. I remember 2 of the Florida doctors, Chowning and Meredith. They not only tended an entire family for $25 a year, but furnished the medicines themselves. Good measure, too. Only the largest persons could hold a whole dose. Castor oil was the principal beverage. The dose was 1/2 dipperful, with 1/2 dipperful of New Orleans molasses added to help it down and make it taste good, which it never did. The next standby was calomel, the next rhubarb, and the next jalap. Then they bled the patient and put mustard plasters on him. It was a dreadful system, and yet the death rate was not heavy. The calomel was nearly sure to salivate the patient and cost him some of his teeth. There were no dentists. When teeth became touched with decay or were otherwise ailing, the doctor knew of but one thing to do. He fetched his tongs and dragged them out. If the jaw remained, it was not his fault. Doctors were not called in cases of ordinary illness. The family's grandmother attended to those. Every old woman was a doctor and gathered her own medicines in the woods and knew how to compound doses that would stir the vitals of a cast-iron dog. And then there was the Indian doctor. A grave savage, remnant of his tribe, deeply read in the mysteries of nature and the secret properties of herbs. And most backwoodsmen had high faith in his powers and could tell of wonderful cures achieved by him. In Mauritius, away off yonder in the solitudes of the Indian Ocean, there is a person who answers to our Indian doctor of the old times. He is a Negro and has had no teaching as a doctor. Yet there is one disease which he is master of and can cure, and the doctors can't. They send for him when they have a case. It is a child's disease of a strange and deadly sort, and the Negro cures it with a herb medicine which he makes himself from a prescription which has come down to him from his father and grandfather. He will not let anyone see it. He keeps the secret of its components to himself, and it is feared that he will die without divulging it. Then there will be consternation in Mauritius. I was told these things by the people there in 1896. We had the faith doctor, too, in those early days, a woman. Her specialty was toothache. She was a farmer's old wife and lived 5 miles from Hannibal. She would lay her hand on the patient's jaw and say, "Believe," and the cure was prompt. Mrs. Utterback, I remember her very well. Twice I rode out there behind my mother, horseback, and saw the cure performed. My mother was the patient. Dr. Meredith removed to Hannibal by and by and was our family physician there and saved my life several times. Still, he was a good man and meant well. Let it go. I was always told that I was a sickly and precarious and tiresome and uncertain child and lived mainly on allopathic medicines during the first 7 years of my life. I asked my mother about this in her old age. She was in her 88th year and said, "I suppose that during all that time you were uneasy about me." "Yes, the whole time." "Afraid I wouldn't live?" After a reflective pause, ostensibly to think out the facts. "No, afraid you would." It sounds like a plagiarism, but it probably wasn't. The country schoolhouse was 3 miles from my uncle's farm. It stood in a clearing in the woods and would hold about 25 boys and girls. We attended the school with more or less regularity once or twice a week in summer, walking to it in the cool of the morning by the forest paths, and back in the gloaming at the end of the day. All the pupils brought their dinners in baskets, corn dodger, buttermilk, and other good things, and sat in the shade of the trees at noon and ate them. It is the part of my education which I look back upon with the most satisfaction. My first visit to the school was when I was 7. A strapping girl of 15 in the customary sunbonnet and calico dress asked me if I used tobacco, meaning did I chew it. I said no. It roused her scorn. She reported me to all the crowd and said, "Here is a boy 7 years old who can't chaw tobacco." By the looks and comments which this produced, I realized that I was a degraded object. I was cruelly ashamed of myself. I determined to reform. But I only made myself sick. I was not able to learn to chew tobacco. I learned to smoke fairly well, but that did not conciliate anybody, and I remained a poor thing and characterless. I longed to be respected, but I was never able to rise. Children have but little charity for each other's defects. As I have said, I spent some part of every year at the farm until I was 12 or 13 years old. The life which I led there with my cousins was full of charm, and so is the memory of it yet. I can call back the solemn twilight and mystery of the deep woods, the earthy smells, the faint odors of the wildflowers, the sheen of rain-washed foliage, the rattling clatter of drops when the wind shook the trees, the far-off hammering of woodpeckers and the muffled drumming of wood pheasants in the remotenesses of the forest, the snapshot glimpses of disturbed wild creatures scurrying through the grass. I can call it all back and make it as real as it ever was and as blessed. I can call back the prairie and its loneliness and peace, and a vast hawk hanging motionless in the sky, with his wings spread wide and the blue of the vault showing through the fringe of their end feathers. I can see the woods in their autumn dress, the oaks purple, the hickories washed with gold, the maples and the sumacs luminous with crimson fires, and I can hear the rustle made by the fallen leaves as we plowed through them. I can see the blue clusters of wild grapes hanging amongst the foliage of the saplings, and I remember the taste of them and the smell. I know how the wild blackberries looked and how they tasted, and the same with the pawpaws, the hazelnuts, and the persimmons. And I can feel the thumping rain upon my head of hickory nuts and walnuts when we were out in the frosty dawns to scramble for them with the pigs, and the gusts of wind loosed them and sent them down. I know the stain of blackberries and how pretty it is, and I know the stain of walnut hulls and how little it minds soap and water, also what grudged experience it had of either of them. I know the taste of maple sap and when to gather it and how to arrange the troughs and the delivery tubes and how to boil down the juice and how to hook the sugar after it is made. Also how much better hooked sugar tastes than any that is honestly come by, let bigots say what they will. I know how a prize watermelon looks when it is sunning its fat rotundity among pumpkin vines and cimblins. I know how to tell when it is ripe without plugging it. I know how inviting it looks when it is cooling itself in a tub of water under the bed, waiting. I know how it looks when it lies on the table in the sheltered great floor space between house and kitchen, and the children gathered for the sacrifice and their mouths watering. I know the crackling sound it makes when the carving knife enters its end, and I can see the split fly along in front of the blade as the knife cleaves its way to the other end. I can see its halves fall apart and display the rich red meat and the black seeds, and the heart standing up, a luxury fit for the elect. I know how a boy looks behind a yard-long slice of that melon, and I know how he feels, for I have been there. I know the taste of the watermelon which has been honestly come by, and I know the taste of the watermelon which has been acquired by art. Both taste good, but the experienced know which tastes best. I know the look of green apples and peaches and pears on the trees, and I know how entertaining they are when they are inside of a person. I know how ripe ones look when they are piled in pyramids under the trees, and how pretty they are and how vivid their colors. I know how a frozen apple looks in a barrel down cellar in the winter time, and how hard it is to bite, and how the frost makes the teeth ache, and yet how good it is notwithstanding. I know the disposition of elderly people to select the specked apples for the children, and I once knew ways to beat the game. I know the look of an apple that is roasting and sizzling on a hearth on a winter's evening, and I know the comfort that comes of eating it hot, along with some sugar and a drench of cream. I know the delicate art and mystery of so cracking hickory nuts and walnuts on a flat iron with a hammer that the kernels will be delivered whole. And I know how the nuts, taken in conjunction with winter apples, cider, and doughnuts, make old people's old tales and old jokes sound fresh and crisp and enchanting. and juggle an evening away before you know what went with the time. I know the look of Uncle Dan'l's kitchen as it was on privileged nights when I was a child, and I can see the white and black children grouped on the hearth, with the firelight playing on their faces and the shadows flickering upon the walls, clear back toward the cavernous gloom of the rear. And I can hear Uncle Dan'l telling the immortal tales which Uncle Remus Harris was to gather into his book and charm the world with, by and by. And I can feel again the creepy joy which quivered through me when the time for the ghost story of the Golden Arm was reached. And the sense of regret, too, which came over me, for it was always the last story of the evening, and there was nothing between it and the unwelcome bed. I can remember the bare wooden stairway in my uncle's house, and the turn to the left above the landing, and the rafters and the slanting roof over my bed, and the squares of moonlight on the floor, and the white cold world of snow outside, seen through the curtainless window. I can remember the howling of the wind and the quaking of the house on stormy nights, and how snug and cozy one felt under the blankets listening, and how the powdery snow used to sift in around the sashes and lie in little ridges on the floor and make the place look chilly in the morning and curb the wild desire to get up, in case there was any. I can remember how very dark that room was in the dark of the moon and how packed it was with ghostly stillness when one woke up by accident away in the night, and forgotten sins came flocking out of the secret chambers of the memory and wanted a hearing, and how ill chosen the time seemed for this kind of business, and how dismal was the hoo-hooing of the owl and the wailing of the wolf, sent mourning by on the night wind. I remember the raging of the rain on that roof summer nights, and how pleasant it was to lie and listen to it, and enjoy the white splendor of the lightning and the majestic booming and crashing of the thunder. It was a very satisfactory room, and there was a lightning rod which was reachable from the window, an adorable and skittish thing to climb up and down summer nights when there were duties on hand of a sort to make privacy desirable. I remember the coon and possum hunts nights with the negroes, and the long marches through the black gloom of the woods, and the excitement which fired everybody when the distant bay of an experienced dog announced that the game was treed. Then the wild scramblings and stumblings through briars and bushes and over roots to get to the spot. Then the lighting of a fire and the felling of the tree, the joyful frenzy of the dogs and the negroes, and the weird picture it all made in the red glare. I remember it all well, and the delight that everyone got out of it except the coon. I remember the pigeon seasons when the birds would come in millions and cover the trees and by their weight break down the branches. They were clubbed to death with sticks. Guns were not necessary and were not used. I remember the squirrel hunts and prairie chicken hunts and wild turkey hunts and all that, and how we turned out mornings while it was still dark to go on these expeditions, and how chilly and dismal it was, and how often I regretted that I was well enough to go. A toot on a tin horn brought twice as many dogs as were needed, and in their happiness they raced and scampered about and knocked small people down and made no end of unnecessary noise. At the word, they vanished away toward the woods, and we drifted silently after them in the melancholy gloom. But presently the gray dawn stole over the world, the birds piped up, then the sun rose and poured light and comfort all around. Everything was fresh and dewy and fragrant, and life was a boon again. After 3 hours of tramping, we arrived back wholesomely tired, overladen with game, very hungry, and just in time for breakfast. Chapter. My uncle and his big boys hunted with the rifle, the youngest boy and I with a shotgun, a small single-barreled shotgun which was properly suited to our size and strength. It was not much heavier than a broom. We carried it turnabout half an hour at a time. I was not able to hit anything with it, but I liked to try. Fred and I hunted feathered small game, the others hunted deer, squirrels, wild turkeys, and such things. Jim and his father were the best shots. They killed hawks and wild geese and such like on the wing. And they didn't wound or kill squirrels. They stunned them. When the dogs treat a squirrel, the squirrel would scamper aloft and run out on a limb and flatten himself along it, hoping to make himself invisible in that way, and not quite succeeding. You could see his wee little ears sticking up. You couldn't see his nose, but you knew where it was. Then the hunter, despising a rest for his rifle, stood up and took offhand aim at the limb and sent a bullet into it immediately under the squirrel's nose. And down tumbled the animal, unwounded but unconscious, The dogs gave him a shake, and he was dead. Sometimes, when the distance was great and the wind not accurately allowed for, the bullet would hit the squirrel's head. The dogs could do as they pleased with that one. The hunter's pride was hurt, and he wouldn't allow it to go into the game bag. In the first faint gray of the dawn, the stately wild turkeys would be stalking around in great flocks and ready to be sociable and answer invitations to come and converse with other excursionists of their kind. The hunter concealed himself and imitated the turkey call by sucking air through the leg bone of a turkey which had previously answered a call like that and lived only just long enough to regret it. There is nothing that furnishes a perfect turkey call except that bone. Another of nature's treacheries, you see. She is full of them. Half the time she doesn't know which she likes best, to betray her child or protect it. In the case of the turkey, she is badly mixed. She gives it a bone to be used in getting it into trouble, and she also furnishes it with a trick for getting itself out of the trouble again. When a mama turkey answers an invitation and finds she has made a mistake in accepting it, she does as the mama partridge does, remembers a previous engagement and goes limping and scrambling away, pretending to be very lame. And at the same time she is saying to her not-visible children, "Lie low, keep still, don't expose yourselves. I shall be back as soon as I've beguiled this shabby swindler out of the county." When a person is ignorant and confiding, this immoral device can have tiresome results. I followed an ostensibly lame turkey over a considerable part of the United States one morning, because I believed in her and could not think she would deceive a mere boy, and one who was trusting her and considering her honest. I had the single-barreled shotgun, but my idea was to catch her alive. I often got within rushing distance of her, and then made my rush, but always, just as I made my final plunge and put my hand down where her back had been, it wasn't there. It was only 2 or 3 inches from there, and I brushed the tail feathers as I landed on my stomach. A very close call, but still not quite close enough. That is, not close enough for success, but just close enough to convince me that I could do it next time. She always waited for me a little piece away and led on to be resting and greatly fatigued. Which was a lie, but I believed it, for I still thought her honest long after I ought to have begun to doubt her, long after I ought to have been suspecting that this was no way for a high-minded bird to be acting. I followed and followed and followed, making my periodical rushes and getting up and brushing the dust off and resuming the voyage with patient confidence. Indeed, with a confidence which grew, for I could see by the change of climate and vegetation that we were getting up into the high latitudes, and as she always looked a little tireder and a little more discouraged after each rush, I judged that I was safe to win in the end, the competition being purely a matter of staying power, and the advantage lying with me from the start because she was lame. Along in the afternoon, I began to feel fatigued myself. Neither of us had had any rest since we first started on the excursion, which was upwards of 10 hours before, though latterly we had paused a while after rushes, I letting on to be thinking about something, and she letting on to be thinking about something else. But neither of us sincere, and both of us waiting for the other to call game, but in no real hurry about it, for indeed those little evanescent snatches of rest were very grateful to the feelings of us both. It would naturally be so, skirmishing along like that ever since dawn, and not a bite in the meantime. At least for me, though sometimes as she lay on her side fanning herself with a wing and praying for strength to get out of this difficulty, a grasshopper happened along whose time had come, and that was well for her, and fortunate, but I had nothing, nothing the whole day. More than once, after I was very tired, I gave up taking her alive and was going to shoot her, but I never did it, although it was my right, for I did not believe I could hit her. And besides, she always stopped and posed when I raised the gun, and this made me suspicious that she knew about me and my marksmanship, and so I did not care to expose myself to remarks. I did not get her at all. When she got tired of the game at last, she rose from almost under my hand and flew aloft with the rush and whir of a shell and lit on the highest limb of a great tree, and sat down and crossed her legs and smiled down at me, and seemed gratified to see me so astonished. I was ashamed and also lost, and it was while wandering the woods hunting for myself that I found a deserted log cabin and had one of the best meals there that in my life days I have eaten. The weed-grown garden was full of ripe tomatoes, and I ate them ravenously, though I had never liked them before. Not more than two or three times since have I tasted anything that was so delicious as those tomatoes. I surfeited myself with them, and did not taste another one until I was in middle life. I can eat them now, but I do not like the look of them. I suppose we have all experienced a surfeit at one time or another. Once, in stress of circumstances, I ate part of a barrel of sardines, there being nothing else at hand, but since then I have always been able to get along without sardines. The latest attempt. Finally, in Florence in 1904, I hit upon the right way to do an autobiography. Started at no particular time of your life, wander at your free will all over your life, talk only about the thing which interests you for the moment, drop it the moment its interest threatens to pale, and turn your talk upon the new and more interesting thing that has intruded itself into your mind meantime. Also, make the narrative a combined diary and autobiography. In this way, you have the vivid things of the present to make a contrast with memories of like things in the past. And these contrasts have a charm which is all their own. No talent is required to make a combined diary and autobiography interesting. And so, I have found the right plan. It makes my labor amusement, mere amusement, play, pastime, and wholly effortless. It is the first time in history that the right plan has been hit upon. The final and right plan. I will construct a text to precede the autobiography, also a preface to follow said text. What a wee little part of a person's life are his acts and his words. His real life is led in his head, and is known to none but himself. All day long and every day the mill of his brain is grinding, and his thoughts, which are but the mute articulation of his feelings, not those other things, are his history. His acts and his words are merely the visible thin crust of his world, with its scattered snow summits and its vacant wastes of water, and they are so trifling a part of his bulk, a mere skin enveloping it. The mass of him is hidden, it and its volcanic fires that toss and boil and never rest night nor day. These are his life, and they are not written and cannot be written. Every day would make a whole book of 80,000 words, 365 books a year. Biographies are but the clothes and buttons of the man. The biography of the man himself cannot be written. Preface, as from the grave. 1. In this autobiography, I shall keep in mind the fact that I am speaking from the grave. I am literally speaking from the grave because I shall be dead when the book issues from the press. At any rate, to be precise, 19/20 of the book will not see print until after my death. I speak from the grave rather than with my living tongue for a good reason. I can speak thence freely. When a man is writing a book dealing with the privacies of his life, a book which is to be read while he is still alive, he shrinks from speaking his whole frank mind. All his attempts to do it fail. He recognizes that he is trying to do a thing which is wholly impossible to a human being. The frankest and freest and privatest product of the human mind and heart is a love letter. The writer gets his limitless freedom of statement and expression from his sense that no stranger is going to see what he is writing. Sometimes there is a breach of promise case by and by, and when he sees his letter in print it makes him cruelly uncomfortable, and he perceives that he never would have unbosomed himself to that large and honest degree if he had known that he was writing for the public. He cannot find anything in the letter that was not true, honest, and respect-worthy, but no matter. He would have been very much more reserved if he had known he was writing for print. It has seemed to me that I could be as frank and free and unembarrassed as a love letter if I knew that what I was writing would be exposed to no eye until I was dead and unaware and indifferent. 2. My editor's heirs and assigns are hereby instructed to leave out of the first edition all characterizations of friends and enemies that might wound the feelings of either the persons characterized or their families and kinship. This book is not a revenge record. When I build a fire under a person in it, I do not do it merely because of the enjoyment I get out of seeing him fry, but because he is worth the trouble. It is then a compliment, a distinction. Let him give thanks and keep quiet. I do not fry the small, the commonplace, the unworthy. From the first, second, third, and fourth editions, all sound and sane expressions of opinion must be left out. There may be a market for that kind of wares a century from now. There is no hurry. Wait and see. 3. The editions should be issued 25 years apart. Many things that must be left out of the first will be proper for the second. Many things that must be left out of both will be proper for the third. Into the fourth, or at least the fifth, the whole autobiography can go unexpurgated. Mark Twain. Here begin the Florentine dictations. John Hay. Florence, Italy, 31st of January, 1904. A quarter of a century ago, I was visiting John Hay, now Secretary of State, at Whitelaw Reed's house in New York, which Hay was occupying for a few months while Reed was absent on a holiday in Europe. Temporarily, also, Hay was editing Reed's paper, the New York Tribune. I remember two incidents of that Sunday visit particularly well, and I think I shall use them presently to illustrate something which I intend to say. One of the incidents is immaterial, and I hardly know why it is that it has stayed with me so many years. I must introduce it with a word or two. I had known John Hay a good many years. I had known him when he was an obscure young editorial writer on the Tribune in Horace Greeley's time, earning three or four times the salary he got, considering the high character of the work which came from his pen. In those earlier days he was a picture to look at, for beauty of feature, perfection of form, and grace of carriage and movement. He had a charm about him, of a sort quite unusual to my Western ignorance and inexperience, a charm of manner, intonation, apparently native and unstudied elocution, and all that. The groundwork of it native, the ease of it, the polish of it, the winning naturalness of it, acquired in Europe where he had been chargé d'affaires some time at the court of Vienna. He was joyous and cordial, a most pleasant comrade. Now I am coming to it. John Hay was not afraid of Horace Greeley. I will leave that remark in a paragraph by itself. It cannot be made too conspicuous. John Hay was the only man who ever served Horace Greeley on the Tribune of whom that can be said. In the past few years, since Hay has been occupying the post of Secretary of State with a succession of foreign difficulties on his hands, such as have not fallen to the share of any previous occupant of that chair, perhaps, when we consider the magnitude of the matters involved, we have seen that that courage of his youth is his possession still, and that he is not any more scarable by kings and emperors and their fleets and armies than he was by Horace Greeley. I arrive at the application now. That Sunday morning 25 years ago, Hay and I had been chatting and laughing and carrying on, almost like our earlier selves of 67, when the door opened and Mrs. Hay, gravely clad, gloved, bonneted, and just from church, and fragrant with the odors of Presbyterian sanctity, stood in it. We rose to our feet at once, of course, rose through a swiftly falling temperature, a temperature which at the beginning was soft and summer-like, but which was turning our breath and all other damp things to frost crystals by the time we were erect. But we got no opportunity to say the pretty and polite thing and offer the homage due. The comely young matron forestalled us. She came forward smileless, with disapproval written all over her face, said most coldly, "Good morning, Mr. Clemens," and passed on and out. There was an embarrassed pause, I may say a very embarrassed pause. If Hay was waiting for me to speak, it was a mistake. I couldn't think of a word. It was soon plain to me that the bottom had fallen out of his vocabulary, too. When I was able to walk, I started toward the door, and Hay, grown gray in a single night, so to speak, limped feebly at my side, making no moan, saying no word. At the door his ancient courtesy rose and bravely flickered for a moment, then went out. That is to say, he tried to ask me to call again, but at that point his ancient sincerity rose against the fiction and squelched it. Then he tried another remark, and that one he got through with. He said pathetically and apologetically, "She is very strict about Sunday." More than once in these past few years I have heard admiring and grateful people say, and have said it myself, "He is not afraid of this whole nation of 80 millions when his duty requires him to do an unpopular thing." 25 years have gone by since then, and through manifold experiences I have learned that no one's courage is absolutely perfect, that there is always someone who is able to modify his pluck. The other incident of that visit was this. In trading remarks concerning our ages, I confessed to 42 and Hay to 40. Then he asked if I had begun to write my autobiography, and I said I hadn't. He said that I ought to begin at once, and that I had already lost 2 years. Then he said in substance this: At 40, a man reaches the top of the hill of life and starts down on the sunset side. The ordinary man, the average man, not to particularize too closely and say the commonplace man, has at that age succeeded or failed. In either case, he has lived all of his life that is likely to be worth recording. Also, in either case, the life lived is worth setting down and cannot fail to be interesting if he comes as near to telling the truth about himself as he can. And he will tell the truth in spite of himself, for his facts and his fictions will work loyally together for the protection of the reader. Each fact and each fiction will be a dab of paint. Each will fall in its right place, and together they will paint his portrait. Not the portrait he thinks they are painting, but his real portrait, the inside of him, the soul of him, his character. Without intending to lie, he will lie all the time, not bluntly, consciously, not dully, unconsciously, but half-consciously, consciousness in twilight. A soft and gentle and merciful twilight which makes his general form comely, with his virtuous prominences and projections discernible, and his ungracious ones in shadow. His truths will be recognizable as truths, his modifications of facts which would tell against him will go for nothing. The reader will see the fact through the film and know his man. There is a subtle devilish something or other about autobiographical composition that defeats all the writer's attempts to paint his portrait his way. Hay meant that he and I were ordinary, average, commonplace people, and I did not resent my share of the verdict, but nursed my wound in silence. His idea that we had finished our work in life, passed the summit, and were westward bound downhill, with me 2 years ahead of him and neither of us with anything further to do as benefactors to mankind, was all a mistake. I had written 4 books then, possibly 5. I have been drowning the world in literary wisdom ever since, volume after volume. Since that day's sun went down, he has been the historian of Mr. Lincoln, and his book will never perish. He has been ambassador, brilliant orator, competent and admirable secretary of state, and would be president next year if we were a properly honest and grateful nation instead of an ungrateful one, a nation which has usually not been willing to have a chief magistrate of gold when it could get one of tin. I had lost 2 years, but I resolved to make up that loss. I resolved to begin my autobiography at once. I did begin it, but the resolve melted away and disappeared in a week, and I threw my beginning away. Since then, about every 3 or 4 years, I have made other beginnings and thrown them away. Once I tried the experiment of a diary, intending to inflate that into an autobiography when its accumulation should furnish enough material. But that experiment lasted only a week. It took me half of every night to set down the history of the day, and at the week's end I did not like the result. Within the last 8 or 10 years I have made several attempts to do the autobiography in one way or another with a pen, but the result was not satisfactory. It was too literary. With the pen in one's hand, narrative is a difficult art. Narrative should flow as flows the brook down through the hills and the leafy woodlands, its course changed by every boulder it comes across and by every grass-clad gravelly spur that projects into its path. Its surface broken, but its course not stayed by rocks and gravel on the bottom in the shoal places. A brook that never goes straight for a minute, but goes, and goes briskly, sometimes ungrammatically, and sometimes fetching a horseshoe 3/4 of a mile around, and at the end of the circuit flowing within a yard of the path it traversed an hour before, but always going, and always following at least one law, always loyal to that law, the law of narrative, which has no law. Nothing to do but make the trip. The how of it is not important, so that the trip is made. With a pen in the hand, the narrative stream is a canal. It moves slowly, smoothly, decorously, sleepily. It has no blemish except that it is all blemish. It is too literary, too prim, too nice. The gait and style and movement are not suited to narrative. That canal stream is always reflecting. It is its nature. It can't help it. Its slick, shiny surface is interested in everything it passes along the banks, cows, foliage, flowers, everything. And so it wastes a lot of time in reflections. Notes on Innocence Abroad, dictated in Florence, Italy, April 1904. I will begin with a note upon the dedication. I wrote the book in the months of March and April 1868 in San Francisco. It was published in August 1869. 3 years afterward, Mr. Goodman of Virginia City, Nevada, on whose newspaper I had served 10 years before, came east. And we were walking down Broadway one day when he said, "How did you come to steal Oliver Wendell Holmes's dedication and put it in your book?" I made a careless and inconsequential answer, for I supposed he was joking, but he assured me that he was in earnest. He said, "I'm not discussing the question of whether you stole it or didn't, for that is a question that can be settled in the first bookstore we come to. I'm only asking you how you came to steal it, for that is where my curiosity is focalized." I couldn't accommodate him with this information, as I hadn't it in stock. I could have made oath that I had not stolen anything, therefore my vanity was not hurt nor my spirit troubled. At bottom, I supposed that he had mistaken another book for mine and was now getting himself into an untenable place and preparing sorrow for himself and triumph for me. We entered a bookstore, and he asked for The Innocents Abroad and for the dainty little blue and gold edition of Dr. Oliver Wendell Holmes's poems. He opened the books, exposed their dedications, and said, "Read them. It is plain that the author of the second one stole the first one, isn't it?" I was very much ashamed and unspeakably astonished. We continued our walk, but I was not able to throw any gleam of light upon that original question of his. I could not remember ever having seen Dr. Holmes's dedication. I knew the poems, but the dedication was new to me. I did not get hold of the key to that secret until months afterward. Then it came in a curious way, and yet it was a natural way. For the natural way provided by nature and the construction of the human mind for the discovery of a forgotten event is to employ another forgotten event for its resurrection. I received a letter from the Reverend Dr. Rising, who had been rector of the Episcopal Church in Virginia City in my time. In which letter Dr. Rising made reference to certain things which had happened to us in the Sandwich Islands 6 years before. Among other things, he made casual mention of the Honolulu Hotel's poverty in the matter of literature. At first I did not see the bearing of the remark. It called nothing to my mind. But presently it did, with a flash. There was but one book in Mr. Kirchhoff's hotel, and that was the first volume of Dr. Holmes's Blue and Gold series. I'd had a fortnight's chance to get well acquainted with its contents, for I had ridden around the Big Island, Hawaii, on horseback, and had brought back so many saddle boils that if there had been a duty on them, it would have bankrupted me to pay it. They kept me in my room, unclothed, and in persistent pain for 2 weeks, with no company but cigars and the little volume of poems. Of course, I read them almost constantly. I read them from beginning to end, then read them backwards, then began in the middle and read them both ways, then read them wrong end first and upside down. In a word, I read the book to rags and was infinitely grateful to the hand that wrote it. Here we have an exhibition of what repetition can do when persisted in daily and hourly over a considerable stretch of time, where one is merely reading for entertainment without thought or intention of preserving in the memory that which is read. It is a process which in the course of years dries all the juice out of a familiar verse of Scripture, leaving nothing but a sapless husk behind. In that case, you at least know the origin of the husk, but in the case in point, I apparently preserved the husk but presently forgot whence it came. It lay lost in some dim corner of my memory a year or two, then came forward when I needed a dedication, and was promptly mistaken by me as a child of my own happy fancy. I was new, I was ignorant, the mysteries of the human mind were a sealed book to me as yet, and I stupidly looked upon myself as a tough and unforgivable criminal. I wrote to Dr. Holmes and told him the whole disgraceful affair, implored him in impassioned language to believe that I had never intended to commit this crime, and was unaware that I had committed it until I was confronted with the awful evidence. I have lost his answer. I could better have afforded to lose an uncle. Of these I had a surplus, many of them of no real value to me, but that letter was beyond price, beyond uncledom, and unsparable. In it Dr. Holmes laughed the kindest and healingest laugh over the whole matter, and at considerable length and in happy phrase assured me that there was no crime in unconscious plagiarism, that I committed it every day, that he committed it every day, that every man alive on the earth who writes or speaks commits it every day, and not merely once or twice, but every time he opens his mouth, that all our phrasings are spiritualized shadows cast multitudinously from our readings, that no happy phrase of ours is ever quite original with us, There is nothing of our own in it except some slight change born of our temperament, character, environment, teachings, and associations. But this slight change differentiates it from another man's manner of saying it, stamps it with our special style, and makes it our own for the time being, all the rest of it being old, moldy, antique, and smelling of the breath of a thousand generations of them that have passed it over their teeth before. In the 30-odd years which have come and gone since then, I have satisfied myself that what Dr. Holmes said was true. I wish to make a note upon the preface of The Innocents. In the last paragraph of that brief preface, I speak of the proprietors of the Daily Alta California having waived their rights in certain letters which I wrote for that journal while absent on the Quaker City trip. I was young then, I am white-headed now, but the insult of that word rankles yet, now that I am reading that paragraph for the first time in many years, reading it for the first time since it was written, perhaps. There were rights, it is true, such rights as the strong are able to acquire over the weak and the absent. Early in 66, George Barnes invited me to resign my reportership on his paper, the San Francisco Morning Call, and for some months thereafter I was without money or work. Then I had a pleasant turn of fortune. The proprietors of the Sacramento Union, a great and influential daily journal, sent me to the Sandwich Islands to write four letters a month at $20 apiece. I was there 4 or 5 months and returned to find myself about the best-known honest man on the Pacific coast. Thomas McGuire, proprietor of several theaters, said that now was the time to make my fortune, strike while the iron was hot, break into the lecture field. I did it. I announced a lecture on the Sandwich Islands, closing the advertisement with the remark, "Admission $1, doors open at 7:30, the trouble begins at 8. A true prophecy. The trouble certainly did begin at 8 when I found myself in front of the only audience I had ever faced, for the fright which pervaded me from head to foot was paralyzing. It lasted 2 minutes and was as bitter as death. The memory of it is indestructible, but it had its compensations, for it made me immune from timidity before audiences for all time to come. I lectured in all the principal Californian towns and in Nevada, then lectured once or twice more in San Francisco, then retired from the field rich, for me, and laid out a plan to sail westward from San Francisco and go around the world. The proprietors of the Alta engaged me to write an account of the trip for that paper, 50 letters of a column and a half each, which would be about 2,000 words per letter, and the pay to be $20 per letter. I went east to St. Louis to say goodbye to my mother, and then I was bitten by the prospectus of Captain Duncan of the Quaker City excursion, and I ended by joining it. During the trip, I wrote and sent the 50 letters. 6 of them miscarried, and I wrote 6 new ones to complete my contract. Then I put together a lecture on the trip and delivered it in San Francisco at great and satisfactory pecuniary profit. Then I branched out into the country and was aghast at the result. I had been entirely forgotten. I never had people enough in my houses to sit as a jury of inquest on my lost reputation. I inquired into this curious condition of things and found that the thrifty owners of that prodigiously rich Alta newspaper had copyrighted all those poor little $20 letters and had threatened with prosecution any journal which should venture to copy a paragraph from them. And there I was. I had contracted to furnish a large book concerning the excursion to the American Publishing Company of Hartford, and I supposed I should need all those letters to fill it out with. I was in an uncomfortable situation, that is, if the proprietors of this stealthily acquired copyright should refuse to let me use the letters. That is just what they did. Mr. Mack, something, I have forgotten the rest of his name, May 20th, 1906, I recall it now, McCrellish, said his firm was going to make a book out of the letters in order to get back the $1,000 which they had paid for them. I said that if they had acted fairly and honorably and had allowed the country press to use the letters or portions of them, my lecture skirmish on the coast would have paid me $10,000, whereas the Alta had lost me that amount. Then he offered a compromise. He would publish the book and allow me 10% royalty on it. The compromise did not appeal to me, and I said so. I was now quite unknown outside of San Francisco. The book's sale would be confined to that city, and my royalty would not pay me enough to board me 3 months. whereas my Eastern contract, if carried out, could be profitable to me, for I had a sort of reputation on the Atlantic seaboard acquired through the publication of 6 excursion letters in the New York Tribune and 1 or 2 in the Herald. In the end, Mr. McCrellish agreed to suppress his book on certain conditions. In my preface, I must thank the author for waiving its rights and granting me permission. I objected to the thanks. I could not with any large degree of sincerity thank the author for bankrupting my lecture raid. After considerable debate, my point was conceded and the thanks left out. Noah Brooks was editor of the Alta at the time, a man of sterling character and equipped with a right heart, also a good historian where facts were not essential. In biographical sketches of me written many years afterward, 1902, he was quite eloquent in praises of the generosity of the Alta people in giving to me without compensation a book which, as history had afterward shown, was worth a fortune. After all the fuss, I did not levy heavily upon the Alta letters. I found that they were newspaper matter, not book matter. They had been written here and there and yonder, as opportunity had given me a chance working moment or two during our feverish flight about Europe, or in the furnace heat of my stateroom on board the Quaker City. Therefore, they were loosely constructed and needed to have some of the wind and water squeezed out of them. I used several of them, 10 or 12 perhaps. I wrote the rest of The Innocents Abroad in 60 days, and I could have added a fortnight's labor with the pen and gotten along without the letters altogether. I was very young in those days, exceedingly young, marvelously young, younger than I am now, younger than I shall ever be again by hundreds of years. I worked every night from 11 or 12 until broad day in the morning, and as I did 200,000 words in the 60 days, the average was more than 3,000 words a day. Nothing for Sir Walter Scott, nothing for Louis Stevenson, nothing for plenty of other people, but quite handsome for me. In 1897, when we were living in Tedworth Square, London, and I was writing the book called Following the Equator, my average was 1,800 words a day. Here in Florence, 1904, my average seems to be 1,400 words per sitting of 4 or 5 hours. With the pen, I mean. This autobiography is dictated, not written. I was deducing from the above that I have been slowing down steadily in these 36 years, but I perceive that my statistics have a defect. 3,000 words in the spring of 1868, when I was working 7 or 8 or 9 hours at a sitting, has little or no advantage over the sitting of today, covering half the time and producing half the output. Figures often beguile me, particularly when I have the arranging of them myself, in which case the remark attributed to Disraeli would often apply with justice and force. There are 3 kinds of lies. Lies, damned lies, and statistics. Robert Louis Stevenson and Thomas Bailey Aldrich. But it was on a bench in Washington Square that I saw the most of Louis Stevenson. It was an outing that lasted an hour or more and was very pleasant and sociable. I had come with him from his house, where I had been paying my respects to his family. His business in the square was to absorb the sunshine. He was most scantily furnished with flesh. His clothes seemed to fall into hollows, as if there might be nothing inside but the frame for a sculptor's statue. His long face and lank hair and dark complexion and musing and melancholy expression seemed to fit these details justly and harmoniously, and the altogether of it seemed especially planned to gather the rays of your observation and focalize them upon Stevenson's special distinction and commanding feature, his splendid eyes. They burned with a smoldering rich fire under the penthouse of his brows, and they made him beautiful. I said I thought he was right about the others, but mistaken as to Bret Hart. In substance, I said that Hart was good company and a thin but pleasant talker, that he was always bright but never brilliant, that in this matter he must not be classed with Thomas Bailey Aldrich, nor must any other man, ancient or modern, that Aldrich was always witty, always brilliant, if there was anybody present capable of striking his flint at the right angle, that Aldrich was as sure and prompt and unfailing as the red-hot iron on the blacksmith's anvil. You had only to hit it competently to make it deliver an explosion of sparks, I added. Aldrich has never had his peer for prompt and pithy and witty and humorous sayings. None has equaled him, certainly none has surpassed him, in the felicity of phrasing with which he clothed these children of his fancy. Aldrich was always brilliant. He couldn't help it. He is a fire opal set round with rose diamonds. When he is not speaking, you know that his dainty fancies are twinkling and glimmering around in him. When he speaks, the diamonds flash. Yes, he was always brilliant. He will always be brilliant. He will be brilliant in hell. You will see. Stevenson, smiling a chuckly smile, I hope not. Well, you will, and he will dim even those ruddy fires and look like a transfigured Adonis backed against a pink sunset. There on that bench we struck out a new phrase, one or the other of us, I don't remember which, submerged renown. Variations were discussed, submerged fame, submerged reputation, and so on, and a choice was made. Submerged renown was elected, I believe. This important matter rose out of an incident which had been happening to Stevenson in Albany. While in a bookshop or bookstall there, he had noticed a long rank of small books cheaply but neatly gotten up, and bearing such titles as Davis's Selected Speeches, Davis's Selected Poetry, Davis's This and Davis's That and Davis's The Other Thing. Compilations, every one of them, each with a brief, compact, intelligent, and useful introductory chapter by this same Davis, whose first name I have forgotten. Stevenson had begun the matter with this question. Can you name the American author whose fame and acceptance stretch widest in the States? I thought I could, but it did not seem to me that it would be modest to speak out in the circumstances. So I diffidently said nothing. Stevenson noticed and said, Save your delicacy for another time. You are not the one. For a shilling, you can't name the American author of widest note and popularity in the States. But I can. Then he went on and told about that Albany incident. He had inquired of the shopman, Who is this Davis? The answer was, An author whose books have to have freight trains to carry them, not baskets. Apparently you have not heard of him. Stevenson said, No, this was the first time. The man said, Nobody has heard of Davis. You may ask all around, and you will see. You never see his name mentioned in print, not even in advertisements. These things are of no use to Davis, not any more than they are to the wind and the sea. You never see one of Davis's books floating on top of the United States, but put on your diving armor and get yourself lowered away down and down and down till you strike the dense region, the sunless region of eternal drudgery and starvation wages. There you'll find them by the million. The man that gets that market, his fortune is made, his bread and butter are safe, for those people will never go back on him. An author may have a reputation which is confined to the surface and lose it and become pitied, then despised, then forgotten, entirely forgotten, the frequent steps in a surface reputation. A surface reputation, however great, is always mortal and always killable if you go at it right, with pins and needles and quiet, slow poison, not with the club and the tomahawk. But it is a different matter with the submerged reputation, down in the deep water, once a favorite there, always a favorite, once beloved, always beloved, once respected, always respected, honored and believed in. For what the reviewer says never finds its way down into those placid deeps, nor the newspaper sneers, nor any breath of the winds of slander blowing above. Down there they never hear of these things. Their idol may be painted clay up there at the surface, and fade and waste and crumble and blow away, there being much weather there. But down below he is gold and adamant and indestructible.